Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, our guest is Dan Schiller, who's a professor here at the University of Illinois. Dan is one of the best-known professors, I think, in the field of communications and information science. He's a joint appointment of GISLIS, the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, and also in the Institute of Communications Research and the College of Communications here. Been a faculty member now in Illinois for just a year. It's a newcomer to the faculty, a year and a half, I guess I would say. Formerly teaching at the University of California at San Diego, Dan Schiller's written four books?
Four or five.
I like it. I mean, loose count. That's how many he's written, including most recently two books directly relevant to the subject we'll be talking about today. Digital Capitalism, published by MIT Press in 1999, thank you. And also Theorizing Communication, published by Oxford University Press in 1996. And both of these really talk, both historically and the present tense, about the crucial issues facing us with telecommunications in our society and the implications for media, for democracy, for self-government. Dan, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, let's get started. You know, I think that sometimes when people hear the term telecommunications, if they're not very familiar with the subject, their eyes glaze over. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of like an instant yawn producer. And then what happens is as soon as they hear a little bit more about it, they realize, wow, this is really interesting. So why don't we're going to try to convince people by the end of this hour to be in the latter camp, assuming a lot of them are in the former camp right now. What is telecommunications, for starters? How do we distinguish that from other types of communications?
The word telecommunications merely means communications at a distance. Conventionally, it's applied to telephone systems and some of their ancestors and successors, telegraph systems earlier on, computer communications networks more recently. It means electronic communications in a point-to-point or now increasingly point-to-multipoint mode.
Ooh, point-to-multipoint mode. Professor, help me here. That means instead of like me calling you up on the phone, more of a broadcasting thing.
The overlap is increasing.
Yeah, okay.
With a technology such as email, which is overlaid over the telephone network, for example, to some extent, yes, you can send an email to 1,000 people if you like. And in that sense, it's one-to-many or point-to-multipoint.
Now, why should anyone really care much about telecommunication? Why doesn't, you know, rate separate study universities? We don't have separate departments to study the hamburger industry or something, or the widget industry.
Maybe we should. But
we do have people who talk about telecommunications and study it closely. What's the importance of it?
Well, there are a number of different ways in which it's important. Economically, it's one of the largest industries in the world, in the United States and elsewhere. At this point, rivals some of the biggest industries that we hear a lot about on a daily basis, the automobile industry.
Yeah, let me interject, because if you were going on a list, I know Fortune magazine and Forbes magazine every year publish their list of the 500 largest companies in the country or the world. Where would you see the 5-10 largest telecom companies? Would they be on that list?
They'd be at the top of that list. They'd be in the top 50 of that list.
So the firms we're talking about that do telephone and telecommunication services are at the very commanding heights of our economy.
Yes, they are. And we're talking here about everything from SBC Ameritech, which has a local presence here in Illinois, to long-distance companies like WorldCom MCI or AT&T, to equipment manufacturers who provision the industry like Lucent or Nortel, to a variety of more specialized providers, particularly of internet-type services that are also involved.
Boy, I hear all these names, and it just makes me think, what a testament to free enterprise in America that we all these companies come about and are so successful. Is the government sometimes meddle in this industry and try to get in the way of entrepreneurs? How does that go?
You're deliberately inciting me, I think, Bob, here.
I'm about to throw a match at you. I've just been squirting you with gasoline.
The industry has always had extensive involvement with government from actually the days prior to any kind of electrical form of telecommunications with the post office. This is partly a matter of government agencies wanting to be very certain about who is sending what kinds of messages from place to place, particularly in times of social stress, such as the Civil War. It'd be hard to imagine a greater stress than that. And also because of the significance of telecommunications as a function for the government itself. Both of these are motives for government involvement. But there's a third motive that I'd like to at least mention. Maybe we'll go into it a little more later, which is that the terms on which telecommunications technologies have been made available to Americans have not always been attractive to small American householders and tenement dwellers themselves. And so they have from time to time mobilized themselves to affect what kinds of rules the government will make to assure that there's greater access to these services. And that's been important.
So today, if you look at the telecommunications industry in the United States, it's formally regulated by the government.
Yes, the Federal Communications Commission at the national level and the state public utility commissions such as the Illinois Commerce Commission here in Illinois.
And traditionally, the telephone systems have been monopolies. Is that right? State-sanctioned monopolies.
And this is it's a very important and a very controversial point.
Yeah, we don't have state-sanctioned monopolies for fast food hamburgers, do we? I mean, why would they have them for telephones?
And we haven't in the recent past had them in telecommunications and telephones either. But this is as a process of elaborate change occurring in the industry starting in the 1960s. From around the 1910s, the 1920s through the 1960s, the industry was provided on a monopoly service basis. AT&T did about 80% of it for local telephone subscribers, and it was the only long-distance company in the United States by deliberate design. The reasons for that are complex, but basically had to do with the fact that it is economically efficient for, and I'm being quite controversial here probably, it's economically efficient for there to be a single monopolist as long as there is some sort of countervailing regulatory authority that's capable of checking abuses.
Is that really such a controversial position? When I studied economics, granted I'm dating myself now, telephone services were called natural monopolies.
That's out the window. Nobody thinks it's a natural monopoly anymore. The Federal Communications Commission and the whole group of economists that advise it informally and formally has been persuaded of a very different logic for 30 years. They think it should be a competitive industry. They do everything that they can to try to push it in that direction, and this will get us into some of the results that are evident so much today in the press and in the carnage that's occurring in the industry, but their policies are directly implicated in the competitive disaster that's occurred.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dan is a professor in both the Library School and the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, and he's the leading expert in telecommunications. This is a pre-recorded show. We got Dan in the studio shortly before we went on air so we could have a moment to talk with him peacefully that would fit into both our schedules, and I want to thank you very much for coming in, Dan.
It's a pleasure.
What that also means, though, is that we aren't taking phone calls today, so just sit back, put your feet up, make a cup of tea, turn up the volume, relax, and listen to these professional yakkers do all the talking this afternoon. Well, you said this natural monopoly idea that telephone systems, or I guess before that telegraphs and even the postal system, are natural monopolies. The economics of that, outside of the politics of it, but the economics were the principle that that the intense heavy cost to set up one of these networks was so high that once you got one going and there were such benefits for the users to be on the same network that once one got off the ground, economically, you could never have any competition. So you could call it a competitive market, but whoever the top dog was eventually would run the whole thing. And therefore, the justification for regulation, as I understood it, the legal justification, not the ethical one, was that since you have a natural monopoly and it gives an enormous amount of commercial power to whoever runs it, that the public, this government has a right to set terms on it. Okay, you can have your monopoly, but you've got to meet certain conditions to keep it. Is that, at least in theory, that's how I understood
it. Yes, that's a very apt summary of the theory behind regulation in the industry. It needs to be added.
Until I finished college, until 30 years ago.
Until 30 years ago. Okay. It needs to be added, though, that even under the older regime, when you did have something that looked a lot like a monopoly, natural or otherwise, there was a big chunk of that system that didn't have to tolerate any real meaningful regulation, which was the equipment manufacturing chunk. Mm-hmm. AT&T also owned, in other words, not only local service affiliates, not only a long-distance network, but also a gigantic equipment manufacturing subsidiary. And by manipulating the prices that subsidiary was able to charge for equipment through the regulatory process, it was able to extract super profits, you might say, from the system. That doesn't have anything to do with the theory of natural monopoly, but mm-hmm. it is a piece of what actually happened in the United States, which is part of what made the natural monopoly regulation trade-off that you've just described amenable or agreeable to AT&T.
Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't hard economic theory. It was just sort of political negotiating that fully determined this. And for a long time, AT&T accepted a certain amount of regulation, but it got a monopoly and other privileges in return for doing that.
Yes. Now, it needs to be added one other thing, that it not only on the favorable side for AT&T executives and shareholders, it obtained a monopoly and made very, very extensive profits. I heard a CEO of AT&T something like 20 years ago describe $300 million as wine for the salad. That's on the favorable side for AT&T. But it also, I think, has to be underscored that particularly from the 1930s into the 1940s and even the 50s, AT&T experienced a substantial and even at times aggressive regulatory structure which pushed it to do things that it would not otherwise have done. Mm-hmm. And this is important to establish. And when I say to push to do things it wouldn't have otherwise done, one of them was to extend residential telephone service to millions of households who under the then prevailing system through the 1930s couldn't have afforded it.
Yeah, I mean, to put this another way, as I understand it, AT&T was allowed to have its monopoly, but it couldn't then do what private companies always do with telecommunications, which is serve the lucrative business markets and upper income markets. It had to guarantee lines going out to farmers, rural people, poor communities that otherwise wouldn't be commercially make a lot of sense for these
exactly.
companies.
Now, a lot of those lines that went out to farmers and rural areas actually were erected by independent companies, and AT&T didn't have anything to do with it except interconnecting with those companies to provide long-distance service. That needs to be said because those independent companies, of whom there are still probably 1,100, 1,200 in the United States, have a proud legacy in their own right and cumulatively are larger than the national telephone systems of most other trading partners of the United States, which gives you some idea of how big AT&T was.
So now we've got AT&T is the monopoly phone service in the United States basically. There's GTE and some of these independents, but they're basically the big dog.
Mm-hmm.
They've got monopoly over long distance, most local service, and this system's in place for a good 40, 50 years. Everyone's happy, it seems like. But then along comes the government in 1983 or four, and it breaks up AT&T and divests it of its monopoly. What was the reason for that? And what led to it? And what were the results of that breaking up of AT&T?
That's a big set of questions. The first and I think most important point to make is that the breakup didn't come up out of thin air. It wasn't something that was contrived out of a bureaucrat's head a year or 3 months before. It culminated a process that was by that time already arguably 15, 20 years or even more old, by which there had been a sort of an erosion, a chipping away episodically at AT&T's monopoly status, and the industry had begun to be placed on a new footing, largely in order to develop a range of new kinds of equipment and services around computer communications, and largely at the behest of large business users of telecommunications of every kind, from banks like Citibank to energy companies like Exxon to big retailers like Sears, which then was a big retailer, mm-hmm. Aerospace companies and so forth. So it was a very diversified group of business users who, as they grew in the post-war environment in the United States and put up multi-unit operations around different parts of the United States, found themselves in the first instance with a greater and greater need of telecommunications to unify the administration and control of their far-flung corporate operations. So there was a cost objective, which was to lower costs and, if possible, to externalize those costs onto somebody else, mm-hmm. namely individual ratepayers. And on the other hand, and this is in a way the more important point, these companies bankrolled the information revolution. Corporation. These companies found themselves increasingly the diversified big businesses of every kind that had a greater and greater need for telecommunications and were paying more and more to acquire telecommunications.
So they're paying a lot of money for their phone systems, basically.
A lot of money. It's
more than they want to pay.
A lot more than they want. It's a highly stratified field, so the top few percentage points of business users.
And the regulations making these big commercial users of phone systems, in effect, subsidize the ability of some poor person, theoretically, to get a phone service.
Well, the issue of subsidy is vexed, but yes, these companies were paying more than they wanted to pay for telecommunications. They were aware of technologies being developed that could allow them to get what they wanted in the way of services more cheaply, and they would not let anything come in between them and that objective. Mm-hmm. If that meant, as it turned out to mean, that smaller users, residential users, might end up paying proportionately more for the local service that they were going to predominate in depending on, then so be it.
Oh, hey, it's the free market.
That's one way of looking at it.
Government-regulated and created market, but a free one nonetheless.
Absolutely. So these big companies, these diversified companies from every sector of the economy asked – and I shouldn't say asked. They demanded of the federal regulatory structure that they be permitted to proceed as quickly as possible with the merger of a whole raft of commercial computer communication services and equipment so that they could satisfy very prosaic functions from accounting to inventory management to production scheduling to a range of other things on the shop floor and in the office buildings. And they received that permission incrementally and episodically. This put to reduce a complex trajectory to just a short statement. This put increasing strain on the prevailing structure and in specific on AT&T. And eventually it placed such strain on it that AT&T's own executives agreed to a divestiture which would, everybody believed, place the entire industry on a new footing and simultaneously satisfy big business users while also unleashing a more general process of information revolution.
And as a consequence of this breakup of AT&T in 1984, was that?
Yes, it was completed in 1984.
The local service is broken up into seven regional companies, what are called the baby bells.
Correct.
And then the long distance service became AT&T was competing in that alongside MCI and Sprint and eventually WorldCom.
The FCC had already authorized competitors to enter long distance service markets, and MCI was the most well known. But as you mentioned, there were others.
Okay, so during the 1980s, after this divestiture, going into the 1990s, we've got. At least at the user end, we're looking at 11 or 12 major phone companies now in the United States, not the two or three that had existed into the 1960s or 70s. And then along comes the telecommunication. But they're still heavily regulated, right? I mean, so like Ameritech, which is our local phone company here in the Midwest, it couldn't do long-distance service. It could only do local telephone service after 1984. The theory being, as I understand it, that since they had a monopoly locally, they could make killer monopoly profits. Then they could go into new markets and they could use their monopoly profits to drive people out of business. So you wouldn't let them use their monopoly profits to go into related industries. They had to stick with local phone
service.
And
it went the other way too, in that the long distance sector, notably AT&T, was not going to be allowed to do everything that it wanted to do in the way of provision of service, although the limits were much less on the long distance side. The irony was that it was widely believed and accepted that it would be the long distance companies that would make out well in this arrangement.
Because they had national networks built up.
And brands. The AT&T brand was one of the most widely known in the United States. And it was seen that AT&T was in the catbird seat and the local operating companies like Ameritech were going to be struggling to survive.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about the telecommunications crisis that has swept the United States the past year and has left some of our largest companies bankrupt, close to bankrupt, and severe crisis, and our entire telecommunications system floundering. And I hope you'll forgive my guest, Dan Schiller, and myself for taking this long time to work us up to the present. It's sort of like a murder mystery or something, and we're still in the middle of Chapter 5. But I think to really understand the nature of this current crisis, you've got to have a sense of the history, the pattern, and the traditions of regulation and ownership that have led us to this point. And at this point in our story, here we are 20 minutes or so into the show. We're into the 1990s now. We have a regulated phone system with roughly 7 regional phone companies, and we've got 4 or 5 other major phone companies that do long distance, or like General Telephone and Electric do local service as well. And we're going into the 1990s, and along comes what is one of the most important bills in recent history by the U.S. Congress, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And what does that do to telecommunications?
Well, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 formalizes and extends the processes that have already been going on now for 30 years by the time that it happens. There is regulation still at the time of that legislation, but it's been all but eviscerated of any meaningful sense in the older form that it was serving in the New Deal era.
The notion of regulating big companies and
the notion of regulating in the public interest, where the public interest meant something besides marketplace efficiency, mm-hmm. was already almost out the window. Mm-hmm. And what the Telecommunications Act of 1996 did was to codify that understanding, namely that from there forward, regulation was in the public interest by definition, according to the Act, if it furthered marketplace efficiency. And so the public interest was equated, pure and simple, with market efficiency and not with any social needs.
So basically, the 96 Telecom Act is really more or less a formal renunciation of the notion of public regulation, regulation of the public interest, with the theory being it would be replaced by regulation by marketplace competition.
Yes. And the regulator's job was to try to introduce marketplace competition where it didn't already exist, mm-hmm. notably in the local exchange or local service area of the telephone system. And in order to produce that result, a whole variety of incredibly obtuse and complicated provisions were developed in consultation with the Federal Communications Commission in order to push local exchange carriers like Ameritech to make available pieces of their local networks to would-be competitors at terms that would seem to be favorable for those competitors.
Yeah, on the surface, this idea that you're going to take a company like Ameritech or any of the baby bells, which owns this wired network that they do all their telephone services over and their other services for that matter, and they own this sort of physical property, and you're going to make this a competitive market. But at the same time, you're not expecting any competitor with Ameritech to come in and build $20 billion worth of wires all over the Midwest. They know that's impossible. Instead, you're going to say, Ameritech, you're going to compete. The other company's going to use your wires too and compete with you and give you healthy competition. And now we're going to negotiate the deal. It seems like you're opening the door to like a lobbyist lawyer paradise. I mean, just backroom arm wrestling. It seems like it's anything but a free market thing. We're saying to entrepreneurs, come in and invest and make the best product.
Oh, absolutely. This is a completely politically negotiated process, which involves lawsuits more than any kind of consideration of marketplace efficiency. There is no unimpeachable economic wisdom on what the proper prices that should be set for a particular element of network provisioning should be. And so it's been a recipe for continued bickering in the courts and for a complete sense of dissatisfaction all around, really.
Now, in the 96 Telecommunications Act, if I – and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm not 100% sure about this – what it did is it said that the FCC should relax the restrictions on the baby bell companies like Ameritech and the other telecommunication companies to move into each other's area, to merge with each other, to begin competing with each other. In theory, that by letting them go into new markets, letting them merge, then you'd have more competition, product investment would increase, the quality of the product
would
improve.
Well, this is sort of at the high point of the pro-competitive philosophy, you might say, that had been germinating for decades by then. The idea was that every segment of the industry should be restructured, if it wasn't already restructured, to be competitive, and then set loose into a grand tumult against every other section of the industry, and each would be free to enter all markets. It's almost antithetical to the terms of the AT&T divestiture, which had been climaxed only 12 years before.
It strikes me, again, as somewhat of a bizarre premise in view of the fact that these wires are owned by one company. And it's not a traditional market in the sense where investors can just come in and start their competition. But in fact, it's all government supervised and all done, as far as I can tell, behind closed doors and by lawyers.
Well, that's true. There does need to be one other point made, which is that there has been some success on the part of some smaller local telephone service companies that have been started up in the last 10 years who have built their own networks exclusively to provide service to business users in central city districts.
Mm-hmm.
That is less of an investment. It's more profitable. And there are certain specialized services that can be provided and that business users want to have. And so for that segment of the market, there has indeed been, although quite a bit of bloodletting, also some notable success. And a growing fraction of local service telephone lines is indeed today being served by these independent companies.
Now, I'm not a real smart guy here, so I'm a little confused about something, Dan Schiller. You've got all these big baby bell companies and these phone companies that helped push through this law in 1996. I don't think they opposed it. I think they were all behind it to varying degrees. And the law is theoretically calling for much more competition. So these guys are pushing through a law that, in theory, we're told, is going to give them all sorts of new competition, which what we know about competitive economics means that with more competition, they'll lose market share. In all likelihood, their profits will come down. They won't win out by it. You wouldn't think they'd be in favor of it. Now, either the rhetoric was wrong or they were idiots and these smart guys who run these companies didn't know what they were doing. What have we learned since 1996? Was the rhetoric wrong or were these guys idiots?
Well, I don't think these people are idiots. I think that there's quite a bit of water under the bridge since 1996. You have to remember, cell phones were just beginning to take off in a major way. Today, you've got 140 million of them in the United States, and they've become a throwaway item.
Yeah, my daughter has half of them.
In 1996, that was only beginning to be visible as the trend, and it hadn't reached the scale that it has now. The internet was just bursting on the scene. Both of these have become major, major threats to conventional telephone service and are being used on an increasing scale. But in 1996, that wasn't as visible. It was looking like a more stable industry.
But I guess the bottom line I'm getting at, going in a little different direction, is that we had 11 or 12 big companies in 1996. Then to encourage competition, we let them all merge and move into new industries fairly quickly. And now we look at how many telecom companies do we have, major telecom companies, not some guys, you know, serving three people in Iowa, but I mean big ones. How many of those 12 have now morphed into, haven't they, five or six or seven?
Yeah, it depends how you count, but it's certainly a smaller number given the fact that, as we can now begin to talk about, I guess some of them have absolutely hit the ropes as a result of the crisis that's enveloped the industry.
Mm-hmm.
The big telephone companies of yesteryear, up to and including AT&T, the long-distance companies are the ones I'm speaking of here, are in dire straits. It's possible that AT&T will cease to be a telecommunications company except insofar as it has a role in cable television.
So if I get this, I mean, we're in a situation where we had, you know, 12 companies, you know, 1996 major companies. We're heading south sharply. We're down to five or six, and several of these are teetering. In the business press, they're talking about how a lot of these are going to have to merge or they're going to have buyouts. We might end up with two or three or four companies. But we're going to be down again close to monopoly in short order. Maybe that natural monopoly theory wasn't as dumb as they all said. Mm. And then – but we aren't going to have any public regulation. Now, that's
right out
of the
books.
That's
the key point. That's absolutely critical point.
All the public gets out of this is a handful of, you know, Milton Friedman slogans. That is their sort of satisfaction for seeing this process take place.
No, that's exactly right. And the situation is such that you're going to see, unless current trends are shifted, back to not quite a monopoly structure and perhaps three or four major companies in the domestic market. But the lack of regulatory controls will be pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this already in any number of ways, from the acceptance of absolutely deplorable service levels in both wireline and wireless telephony, to charges that are being leveled for just about any kind of item that a telephone company can get away with charging you for. Information used to be a free service.
Mm-hmm.
Now information you pay, what is it, $1.99 a hit?
Yeah, yeah.
So for ordinary people, particularly when you remember that going back to your very first question, the telephone is a lifeline. The telephone is a way of reporting sickness, accident, disability, or difficulty. It's something that for shut-ins and ordinary people has fantastic importance that can even be life-threatening in its absence. And so this is the sort of situation that is being created through the absence of regulatory strictures today.
Forgive me for being, you know, cynic or depressed about this, but it certainly sounds on the surface like we're going back to like almost a Gilded Age type environment.
That's a very, very apt description. I mean, the Gilded Age robber barons were very interested in a financial sense in the telecommunications industry. People like Jay Gould speculated against the then towering Western Union Company to the point that they were able to take it over. To continue to withhold service from 95% of the American population along the way. We don't have that particular problem today. The service is available on a wider level than ever before, and that's a good thing. But the level of service, the quality of service, the things that come with the service, the commercialization of the system so you can't listen to your family talking over dinner because you're going to be interrupted by a telemarketer, the abuses of the system, the fact that the telephone companies use the private data that they collect about your calling habits and sell that data to would-be marketers trying to produce further calling at dinner hour whenever they think they can reach you. These are abuses that need to be corrected and that in the absence of any kind of a strong regulatory presence won't be corrected.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to let you know that we're doing this in the studio slightly shortly before going on air so we could work our schedules out. So if you're listening, please don't try to call in today. Just turn the volume up, put your feet up, have a cup of tea, enjoy. Let us do the yakking. We're pretty good at it. Dan, let's get to WorldCom now, which is really, you know, where we started the show, this enormous scandal in the year 2002 about this huge company that's been put together in the last 4 or 5 years and now has basically collapsed. And you, I might say, to pat you on the back, Dan Schiller, wrote a memo when WorldCom, when first emerged, was it with MCI?
When they took over MCI.
Took over MCI, predicting that this would not work, saying this is not a economically feasible merger. Just isn't going to cut it. Unfortunately for workers, investors, and the public, that no one paid attention to you in Washington, D.C., because I don't think your lobbying unit was very powerful in understanding how these things work. But what happened? What happened to WorldCom? Why? Because you'd think with all these monopolies we're getting, in economic theory, once you have only a handful of companies left, they clean up. You know, they own the field. They start raking in the money. That's why Gates is so rich and all these other guys.
Well, again, it's a fairly complex story. WorldCom put itself together over 20 years. Not just out of 4 or 5, the big deals that made it a recognizable brand name came only in the last 4 or 5 years, but it's been developing through about 20 years.
A long-distance company primarily?
Long-distance and particularly internet service provider for big users of the internet. WorldCom was put together by Wall Street. WorldCom was depending on Wall Street for every iota of its financial power to assemble these deals. So when WorldCom offered, I think it was 20-some billion dollars for MCI back in 1998, it was valuing MCI at about double what the stock market had valued MCI at 2 months before that. How could it do that? WorldCom was able to do that because its own stock, WorldCom stock, was a high flyer. It was going up and up and up. Why was it going up and up and up? Because the investment analysts and the financiers on Wall Street were talking up the stock week to week and month to month to make it think that it could never go down. It would never deteriorate. So they kept that stock higher and higher and higher, and WorldCom used it to buy MCI at double the value of MCI.
Sort of like how AOL could use its inflated stock price to buy Time Warner.
Direct parallel. But the only difference is that in this case, it's fairly clear there was criminal misconduct involved in a very direct way.
In WorldCom.
In the WorldCom case.
And why so much criminal conduct in telecom and not why that more than other industries?
Well, it's partly the I mean, the short answer is just the sheer profit that can be made here. Every time one of these big deals was done between WorldCom and an MCI, say, there'd be, you know, $50, $60 million going to Wall Street financiers and lawyers for putting it together. So there was a direct bottom line impact on the service businesses, the investment banks, the PR firms, the lawyers, and so forth that helped to assemble the deals. In a longer range sense, the issue of why this kind of shenanigans would go on in telecommunications was, again, returning to the fact that it's become the central production base and control structure of the advanced economies, where these networks are now running everything that we do, almost from when we get up in the morning to when we go to sleep at night, at work and at home. We're connecting, we're interacting with these networks, and the investment that's required to make that happen is almost without comparison. There's the last quarter for which the Department of Commerce has figures, investment for 2002 second quarter, and this is in the middle of a slump, is on the order of $390 billion
investment
on an annual
telecom
scale. Investment in information technology.
Okay, so, I mean, WorldCom is sort of, you know, getting all this rap for being the sort of chicanery and crooks and monkeying around with their books. These guys, you're telling me, are also paying a lot of money building up a system, actually doing some real investing?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question about that. But the thing is that at a certain point, the stresses on this system, and we've talked a little bit about them as a result of the destabilizing emphasis on competition that was introduced. These guys believed, a lot of them, in some of this rhetoric. And at a certain point, the system began to register increasing stress. The internet diverted increasing numbers of calls and telecom services. Wireless phones began to take to eat the lunch of the long-distance companies. And suddenly, it didn't look as rosy as it had previously, you know, a year or two before. And it's at that point that at a number of companies, not at all of them, but at a number of them, you begin to get fraud. You begin to get accountants cooking the books. You begin to get institutionalized patterns of corruption.
So let me get this, if I understand it right. What's happening is there are a handful of firms, each wanting to sort of dominate this market. They see it as a booming market. Their stock price is going up. So they're building up their networks. They're investing a lot of money. They're raising capital. They're buying other companies. And then they're really overbuilding.
They overbuilt to the point that you have now. It is arguable. Some people have said you may have 500 times the capacity that's needed in the long-distance market.
That's a lot. That's pretty impressive how they can overbuild that much, I guess.
But it's a classic pattern of development when you have a competitive system, which develops in this way in difference to the railroads, did something comparable in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
This is a classic problem. It's a problem that regulation was specifically inserted to try to divert, to keep it from happening. It has happened. And now
it sounds like my natural monopoly professor back in 1972 hit the nail on the head. He had all these people build out. And, you know, they spent a fortune, but you really can't have all of them survive. And there's a lot of this money is just going to get
And when the recognition that they were not all going to be able to survive began to percolate up into the executive suites is when you began to get at some of the companies the sort of corruption that we're seeing.
Because the word on the street was this is still a hot stock and you've got all these blowhards at Fortune magazine and Wired magazine writing about it. So you can still – you've got a window there before the truth gets out to clean up, and that's what WorldCom tried to do.
Or at least to make it to the next quarter.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, cash out your stock options, which is exactly what the top executives did to the tune of some billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
People like Philip Anschutz at Quest, Joseph Nacio at Quest.
Now, who's Quest? We hear about this company. These guys just came out of the blue. Who's Quest? Sounds like some sort of
That's just another entity that provides local telephone service in the area that used to be Rocky Mountain Bell.
It used to be U.S. West?
Used to be U.S. West. Quest took it over and assembled it in common with some other properties that they own. Just another previously unknown huge company, which is now again down, if not bankrupt, then close to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what's the status now? I mean, you got WorldCom, which was a huge company very recently, basically bankrupt.
WorldCom is in bankruptcy proceedings, and the question of on what terms it will emerge go beyond WorldCom's own survival. They go beyond the jobs of the people that work at WorldCom. They go beyond the subscribers who take WorldCom MCI's service. I say that because it has the potential to further destabilize an already destabilized industry for a variety of, again, fairly obtuse reasons. But the process of bankruptcy itself, if it was to leave WorldCom healthier by paring its debt, mm-hmm. which is what characteristically the bankruptcy process does, mm-hmm. would create a much stronger competitor in an industry that is suffering from way too much competition.
We're talking to Dan Schiller today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dan, let's say I'm made king for a day and I appoint you head of the FCC and commissar of telecommunications, and you can basically go in and be in charge of this industry for a day. What would you do? You can't say resign.
Well, I'd be tempted. You know, it's a question of unscrambling eggs in a certain way. I think the first thing is that there has to be a guarantee of uninterrupted service for residential as well as business user subscribers. There has to be some sort of effort to guarantee jobs and pension funds for the employees of the industry that's become a major, major employer, but has also shed hundreds of thousands of jobs over the last 5 years as a process of that we've just described of growing competitive warfare has increased and intensified. We have to put a stop to that. And then I think the having done those two things, there has to be an intense and open-ended national discussion about what should be the priorities for telephone and telecommunications service. Should it be specialized services for business users, which only they can afford and only them want? Or should it be that the priority should go back to being residential services for individual households and without all of the fancy bells and whistles that is presently where the local operating companies are making their money, things like call forwarding and call waiting and so forth.
So basically, the market is voted. The money is in serving business customers and fancy schmancy things for upper middle class and middle class consumer users. It's not in serving the broad population.
That's correct.
And that's going to require public intervention.
Absolutely.
If it's left to the market, it's just not going to happen.
Well, I think it can get a lot worse before it gets better. If you, for example, look at the wireless sector as the bellwether of the industry and you think about the service levels that are tolerable and tolerated in the wireless sector, dropped calls, you can't get information. You don't know how to reach somebody. This is becoming the dominant form of telecommunications provision, and it represents a marked deterioration of what had been standard through the 1960s and 70s. We need to find a way to stabilize the level of service provision in a way that is more adequate to the needs of the population of this country.
But isn't the wireless market, cowboy capitalism, a bunch of entrepreneurs out there stringing up satellites and competing to give the people what they want?
Well, yeah, but in a way, that's my point. The more and more they've succeeded beyond their wildest expectations. There's 140 million cell phones in the United States alone. There's a billion around the world. And so it is in many cases becoming a substitute for a wireline phone of the sort mm-hmm. that we've depended on in the past. That process is likely to continue.
And how many big cell phone companies are there, wireless companies are there in the United States?
There's probably about five or six.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, again, another group of oligopolist companies. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be unless there's countervailing energy, there's going to be a shakeout there. And there already are signs that some of them are beginning to think about merging.
Mm-hmm. So we go down to two or three or something like
that. You don't know exactly how many, but it's definitely consolidating.
It's not going to be 12 a year from now.
And this is now happening by design. If you read the newspaper stories and if you pay attention to the trade press in the area, the basic tenor of everything is we now have to prepare the way for a new cycle of consolidation, and everybody is acting very knowledgeable and serious-minded about this as if they had themselves been saying the same thing only 2 years ago when, of course, what they were saying was we need more competition. We need more competition.
Yeah. Now, didn't you say we need a public debate and discussion? That's what you're going to do as commissar of telephones or telecommunication. I mean, didn't we have a public debate about that 1996 Telecommunications Act?
That act was passed through a process as undemocratic and underhanded as just about any legislative handling that I can imagine. The Senate, I think,
could you be a little more emphatic, please? Don't mince your words here.
Well, there was what's called a manager's amendment introduced into the passage of the legislation, which meant that it proceeded free of all public scrutiny. It was like backroom deals. It
what's
was run
called?
By a manager's amendment, and the manager in this instance was Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
The the act was passed by Senate an hour after it was passed by the House. It was passed by the House by about 390-20, and then it was passed by the Senate in like 91-4.
That must have been a great law. I mean, they've passed it, so much acclaim.
Well, it's an important truth that lies behind it. The deregulatory pro-competitive philosophy was a bipartisan one. It was never locked on to just one part or the other. And today the effort is that made that much more difficult for this reason, because we have to try to think about how to restructure our telecommunications system pretty much against the mainstream approach for the last 30 years.
I'll tell you a story about the Telecommunications Act. There's a member of Congress, I won't name him to protect his identity, but he's on the relevant committee in the House that handled the law, the Telecom Act. And I was talking to him last year, and he was unaware of provisions in the law itself that deregulated radio station ownership. He didn't even know it was in there. He said, well, that got sort of stuck in after I saw it. I didn't even realize it was in there. And he was unaware of what the FCC was doing as a result of that act to deregulate ownership of other media. And he was on the actual committee. You can only imagine what it would be like for a member of the House or Senate who wasn't on the relevant committee to know what was going on. He was completely ignorant of the law.
Well, I mean, that's a very fascinating thing. And I do want to add to that, though, that there is a deliberate process of development in these directions. And right now there are efforts underway to, once again, as we've suggested already today, expedite the process of consolidation across the greater communications industry. And this isn't happening because of an accident or an oversight. It's happening because there are strong interests at work that want to see this kind of a result and that see it as the only way out of the morass.
Now, telephones aren't the only form of telecommunication. Another one that's sort of related, and this is where telecommunication and media really get very closely intertwined, is cable TV, which is another wire. And these wires go all over the country. And it's become, you know, people – what percentage of Americans now get their television via cable?
About 70.
It's a huge percentage of the population. It provides a broadband internet service now to lots of people in the United States. And AT&T is in the process of selling their stake, but currently, and they were in the midst of selling it. They're the largest cable company, and they were premised their deal, AT&T, when they got into cable broadcasting, was they were going to see this convergence of telephony, of telephone usage of these wires, along with television and internet. They were going to have this grand merger. And what's happened to that? The idea that the cable wires would be phone wires and that the phone wires would give us TV and that then these would be a big competition between these huge giants.
Well, I think the reality of what they call convergence remains. I don't see it going away. I think it's going to continue. But I also think that the time frame is different than the one that was proposed, which is as if it's going to happen in 2 months. In the meantime, the process of industry consolidation is accentuated, is furthered. And so instead of having a lot of small companies delivering a whole range of converging services from TV to telephone and so forth, what we're going to have, as we said before, but across a larger chunk of the communications landscape, is a small number of companies delivering a larger range of services.
What does this have to do with the internet exactly? I mean, how, you know, at one time, certainly at the time of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, the specter of the internet was such that all concerns of concentrated ownership went out the window. Because who cares if Rupert Murdoch owns all the newspapers or if the phone company owns everything? If, you know, you can go online and you can go to any website you want, and you can do your own thing and start your own website, you know, life is good. They can't stop you. It's the perfect radical free technology. And how does this telecommunications crisis affect the internet?
Well, that's a good question, and as all the other ones you've been asking, it's got many dimensions to it. But basically, the internet is not any less able of being colonized than any other communications technology. This is not something that is recognized even today by a fair number of people who are able to use the internet for their own purposes, just to go on the web wherever they like, and academics, of course, are prominent among them, and who don't get necessarily brought into the colonized areas as often as most of the population of internet users. But something like 40-50% of internet users in the United States never go off AOL. and stay on the same service for the same limited sets of proprietary marketing objectives all the time.
But I mean, it's not like AOL. If you go off AOL, someone comes to your house and shoots you or something. I mean, they could go off AOL.
Yeah, they could go off. They just don't. To. Well, there's a tremendous people listen to the same two or three radio stations around the dial as well, and so the companies are able to play off this, take advantage of it, and then consolidate in light of that.
But I mean, how does the telecom thing affect internet to make it less open? That's what I'm trying to get. Or does it? I mean, does the fact that we're going to only have a few, we're only going to have very soon, three or four telephone companies, maybe a couple wireless companies, and three or four cable companies that control the entire range of these services, is that going to affect it? That wouldn't be the case if we had a regulated monopoly or if we had more competitive industry.
One way in which the trend towards consolidation can affect internet services is in terms of affecting the price for the prices that's charged for carrying data across the internet pipes. Mm-hmm. And if the telecommunications companies that perform that function begin to dwindle down to a few prominent companies, then they are able to extract value from or extract concessions from those who would seek to send data across the internet on terms that are increasingly biased in their own favor. That hasn't happened yet, but it's something that we could be concerned about. Things are in flux. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the industry, and we can point to possibilities and say we want to go this way and not that way. But in order to make the possibilities that we endorse actual and to realize them, it's going to take policy intervention on a scale that we have not seen and in a direction that we haven't gone for 35 years.
Wow, that's pretty scary talk. We're going to have to go away from the free market. But isn't the free market in telecommunications the American way? Isn't that what Jefferson and Madison had in mind when they helped set up the Constitution, that we'd have free market entrepreneurs who would run our telecommunication systems?
Well, perhaps according to the Progress and Freedom Foundation or the Cato Institute. But these things change, decade to decade.
Well, let's go back actually to the Constitution. I mean, what the first great telecommunication system in this country was the post office. I mean, it dominated even more so than telephones. What role did entrepreneurs play in the post office?
Basically, they at various junctures tried to subvert it and were eventually told they weren't going to be allowed to do that any longer. And the post office was consolidated and survived as a great American institution for 100 years.
As a nonprofit, non-commercial, publicly run monopoly.
Absolutely.
And it's in the Constitution, isn't it?
I mean, there is a constitutional provision for a postal service that should be administered by the government.
Mm-hmm. So there is a long tradition of public involvement here. It predates any private involvement by decades.
About every 50 years, there's a movement to try to reinsinuate private enterprise into telecommunications, and it flops. Mm-hmm. And we are in the middle of the most gigantic of those flops. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, right now, telecommunications has become the central production control mechanism, as I've said, for the larger economy. And this is new. And so the flop matters more.
Well, the last one of these moments, which would have been the 30s and 40s, that period you've been talking about.
Well, even a little earlier, the 20s.
And before that, in debates over telegraphy and the post office, I mean, there was a fairly vibrant public culture, wasn't there, that was, understood the importance of this and was willing to fight for it and make an issue out of it. Do you see, as you look around the horizon today, that that's on the horizon now for the United States, that there's a public that's going to demand telecommunications remain a public service or become one?
Well, Bob, I don't like to be too pessimistic, and I think there may be grounds for at least limited optimism simply because of the range of functions that the telecommunications infrastructure today must perform because of its new centrality, because of its pervasive quality. And so I think for that reason, there is possibility of human intervention to make things better.
Well, thank you very much, Dan Schiller, for joining us today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. It's really been a pleasure to have you here and to have you share your expertise with us. Dan Schiller is the author of Theorizing Communication and Digital Capitalism. He's a professor here at the University of Illinois. Thank you again for
My pleasure.
Coming to the studio. And I want to thank Ben Scott for producing the show.